Well, would you turn to me, please, to that psalm that I read, Psalm 11. Psalm 11, and I want us this evening to center our thoughts around the third verse of that psalm. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Very important, very vital, very significant question. And taking that as a base, as it were, I want to look at the whole of the psalm in the light of that. I have, to be honest, preached on this before, not here, I don't think, but in other situations. And I was looking at some of the notes I made on that occasion some years ago, and I was expressing the concern that we see in society that so many of the foundations that are so right and proper and so necessary for a stable society were being destroyed, were being undermined. Having a look at it now, it has got considerably worse. As we see the way that things are going, in what is being taught, what is being upheld, what is being encouraged, and at the same time what is being dismissed, what is being ignored, what is being rejected. And we are troubled, or I hope we're troubled, that that is the case. And perhaps this question has actually come into our own minds, not exactly perhaps in the terms that it is expressed here, but, you know, what can we do? People have said this to me more frequently over recent months. Well, what is happening? Why is it happening? Why are people doing this? Why are these decisions being taken? And it is worrying. It is troubling. But before we come on to seek to answer that question, we need to remind ourselves of what the foundations actually are. Now, there are many of them, but I'm going to suggest some that we find in the opening book of the scripture, the book of Genesis. In Genesis 1 and 2, foundations for society, foundations for good living, foundations for pleasing God, that are absolutely vital. It's been a great privilege for me to be able to go to our building site on regular occasions, a couple of times, sometimes three times a week, and to take photographs of the work that is going on. The photographs that I took at the beginning, if I hadn't taken them then, I certainly couldn't take them now, because they were the photographs of foundations. Of how, even before they cleared all the soil, they were piling, they laid those piles that form the foundations. Well over 300 of them. And it's those of Cus that will give the stability to the building to ensure that it is secure. But unless that building is knocked down and the whole lot is dug up again, they're never ever going to be seen again. And that is the whole point. Foundations are not in that sense to be observed, but they are there. And it's essential that they are there. The Lord, of course, takes up the same truth when he speaks of those two men building their homes. One building a home on sand, the other on the rock. But when the storms came, the house on the sand just fell apart because there was no strength of foundation. The one on the rock stood firm because that foundation was there. And this is what we are thinking of. Now, it's true to say, of course, that the foundations that we are so concerned about are not hidden, in the sense the foundations of buildings are. But it's true to say that those foundations are absolutely essential. Because you may build, as it were, a building, you may build a system of truth that says in many ways the right things, but it's not actually based on the right foundation. Those truths will fail. When the storm does come, when there's criticism, when there's attack, when there is a determined effort to undermine them. But if the truth we proclaim is on these secure foundations, it will stay. And the first of these, of course, is life. Life itself. Life is being treated so cheaply these days. It matters not to so many that unborn human beings are slaughtered, millions of them. It matters not that the thought of so many is that if you are ill and the prognosis is very serious, there's no hope of recovery, you just take that life. It's even been proposed in some countries now that you just need to reach a certain age. You might be perfectly healthy, might not be any problems, but you can elect. Well, certainly this is being proposed, you can elect to have your life taken. Life is treated so cheaply because they forget what life is. Life is not that we have created. Life is not that we control. Life is that is God-given. All life is in His hand, for He is the Creator. And without Him, there would be no life. And I'm sure we all know situations where it seemed totally inevitable that life would cease in an individual, but something intervened and that was not the case. Because none of us know when that life will end. For it's in His hands. And that's especially so, of course, with man. Life for man was created in a very special way. Men and women are totally distinct from the animal creation. For God formed them out. He formed Adam out of the dust of the ground. And He breathed into him that life-giving spirit. He became a living being. And He took that rib from Adam and formed Eve. Human life is so vital, is so important, and human life is a great gift. And that life must be valued. And that applies to all human life, not just to those who profess to be Christians, but all human life is His creation, and all human life is in His hands. For He is our Creator God. We thank God, of course, for the amazing skills that have been given to those in the medical profession that are able to deal with illnesses now that just a few years ago would have inevitably led to death. And that is a great gift, but it's a gift of God. It's not just down to their ability. Good that that is, and right that that is. And we thank God that that is so. But he is still the one who has enabled that. There are many inventions that have taken place that have helped with this over the centuries, have shown the hand of God in them. For he is the one who works these things. So the life itself is a fundamental foundation, and life needs to be protected. Life needs to be sustained. For life is such a valuable thing. The problem, of course, with the world is that they define life simply in selfish terms. Life is only for the time that we spend on this earth. But that's a very minor part of what the whole of life is. For we are all destined to eternity. Whether that be eternity in heaven in glory with Christ, whether it be hell, experiencing the wrath of God, it's only dealt with by the grace of God and the change that he makes in individual lives. Another thing is work. Adam and Eve were created and placed in that garden. But they weren't placed in that garden just loll about and laze about all day. They were to work. For work is a God-given thing. Work, again, is an essential thing. It has changed, of course, with the rebellion that they were involved in, the sin that they had committed, and work has become, in many respects, a very arduous thing. But the principle still is that that is a foundation. We've been created to work. But in our society, we find that there are so many who don't want to work, who find work irksome, that for them, leisure and pleasure is the more important thing, and they want more time in order to enjoy that leisure and enjoy that pleasure. Now, there is nothing wrong, of course, in enjoying the things that we enjoy. I don't know, maybe you saw Mo Farah get his gold medal the other evening. That was a very enjoyable thing, a lovely thing. We opened our windows when the medal presentation was taking place and we could hear the crowd. You don't hear that with West Ham, even when they score goals. You could hear the crowd. That's a delight, it's a joy. And there are many different things, of course. And we haven't time to list all those. It would be nonsense to seek to do so. But work is still vitally important. We are created to work. Paul, you remember in Ephesians, he speaks of those pagans who've been converted. And he says, let him who steals, steal no more. But let him work with his hands, providing for those in need. Jesus himself tells us that he came to do the work that his Father had sent him to do. And that is the case, that we do work. When we're ashamed of our work, and it is a tragedy when people don't see work in that way, and when society does not provide the opportunity for that work that it ought. A third foundation is the Sabbath. The day that God set apart, particularly for him to be worshipped. It's clearly enshrined in the Ten Commandments, both as recounted in Exodus and Deuteronomy. In Exodus, the reason is the fact that after creation, God rested. In Deuteronomy, it concerns the redemption of Egypt that the people had experienced. And that day is a vital day. It's not much that God expects from us to give him one day in seven. And all the others, we do our work, we fulfill our family responsibilities, we have our leisure, we enjoy these things. Is it unreasonable for God to say to us that day, I want you to treat in a proper way and a special way as mine? But that seems to be lacking. It's certainly lacking in the world, but they see no point of that. It was during the Second World War that the government decided to work an 8-day week. They thought that it would be far more productive, and you could see the sense in that. You could see the reason in that. But they had to give it up because it didn't work. And this weekly pattern of that one day that is God's does work. And when that is applied properly, not just amongst believers, amongst the society, it does have very real benefits. The problem we face perhaps is that so many believers don't see that. Or they might come and do their bit, as it were, in the church for a couple of hours or so, but then they do what they like. No, that's not the point. We need to use that whole day for him and his honor and his glory. Then a fourth foundation, marriage and the family. That has been under such strong attack over recent times. I doubt if any of us really would have thought, had we been asked not very long ago, will same-sex marriage be accepted in our society? We would have said, no, that can never happen. But it has. But prior to that, marriage was demeaned. Marriage was not seen truly for what it should be. And people didn't worry too much about marriage. I've heard Christians argue that, you know, it's all right if you truly love one another, you can live together. You don't have to go through a marriage. It's far too expensive for the wedding, rather. It's far too expensive for a start. It is not. I did work out the figures. If someone got married at the register office at Hackney and didn't have all the trimmings, it's not much at all, £200 or £300. The problem is that we are all affected by what we think weddings should be. And that's often the reason why people will live together as if married and then perhaps sometime have that wedding. Others, they live together and then they say, oh, we get fed up. And they go off with someone else. And the family is being attacked. In the marriage ceremony, or certainly the older one, it was put forward as one of the reasons for marriage is the stability of society. It can only be good and secure when the marriage bond is held in honor. In so many places today, it's not. It is rejected. And coupled with Atticus just recently is this whole concept of gender. I think I said a couple of weeks back that when you read creation, that God says he created man in his own image after his likeness, male and female, he created them. And you think, well, was it really necessary to say male and female? Yes. I wonder if perhaps they argued that 6 months ago. We certainly need to argue that now. For it is absolutely necessary. That is the order that God has given. And it's not just up to an individual to say, oh, I don't think I am a man, I'm going to be a woman, or vice versa. And it's certainly not right, ever, for children to be taught that that is the case. These foundations are being destroyed. These foundations are being totally ignored. They're seen as just mere tradition that has no relevance, no point, no substance for our modern 21st century. If those foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? This was the problem for the psalmist. He speaks in the opening verses of the despair that he feels. He says, In the Lord, I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? Behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string, to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. Total despair. We can understand that. We can understand believers today being in that despair because, we're fighting against such immense powers. And they seem always to have the upper hand. And all seems on the face of it, as it were, to be lost. Well, what can we do? What can we do here in East London today? What action can we take? What particular strategies, as it were, can we put in place to seek to stem that ever-powerful tide, a tsunami virtually, that is seeking to sweep away all that that makes society strong, that honors God, that acknowledges our place before God. Well, the psalmist goes on. And he gives us four things that we must never forget. That we must always act upon. When these attacks are coming. Firstly, God is sovereign. Verse 4. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. God has not changed. God has not been diminished in any way. The same God who called creation into being, the same God who said, "Let there be light," and there was light, the same God who created man, is just as powerful, is just as effective, is just as mighty as he ever was. For God is not going to be defined by people's conception of him. He is always going to stand aside from that because he is God. And it makes absolute sense, of course, to believe that God is truly sovereign, because any diminution of that sovereignty would take away his Godhead. He wouldn't be God. Yet we seem to lose sight of this so easily. A couple of weeks or so ago, Judy and I went to see our GP and to check up, mainly for Judy. He was asking how we are. He knows we shared, you know, difficulties we had with the family. Difficulties in the sense of problems the family have faced, not that the family is difficult. That, you know, we've done that a number of times, and we said again about the fact of Stephen Madeline's accommodation, all that was happening there. And he said that it's very difficult, and you see that can have an effect, particularly on Judy's health. And I said, but we are totally confident that that is going to be dealt with, that they will have somewhere. He happened to phone up with results of a blood test for Judy on the day that Madeline and Steve heard they got a place. And I had a word with him, and I said, I just want to let you know quickly that we just heard that our daughter and son-in-law have a place. And they'll be moving there very soon. And he was delighted, he would have thought it was his place. He was absolutely thrilled. But what he did say to me, he said, I know you were confident, he said, but I think your confidence was misplaced. Or he did think my confidence was misplaced. Because the world doesn't understand. Now, we need to be a bit careful. I'm not, as I said before, I'm not preaching fatalism. Sit back, let God do it, and that is it. No, but we need to always have clearly in our minds that our God is absolutely sovereign. But the next thing is that that sovereignty is a sovereignty in which he is aware of what's going on. There are those sovereign in the sense of the world, the different nations and so on, particularly more so perhaps in the past, that had no real awareness at all of what their people were actually like. It was just that inner council that they consulted all the time, and they didn't know what was going on in the real world. Now, that's never the case with God, for he always knows. Verse 4 again, the second part, he says, his eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. He sees, he knows. And he's in control of those things. We said before, I'm going to say it many more times this year. We celebrate on the 31st of October the nailing by Martin Luther of his 95 thesis on the church door of Wittenberg. And not that he was really expecting this, that sparked off such a move, the Reformation. Prior to that, there were many of the same problems. There was the Holy Roman Empire that controlled the whole of Europe and tried to keep that control with an iron hand. There was the false teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. There have been sort of spots of light, as it were, beforehand. People like John Huss and John Wycliffe, but in the time of Luther, things came to a head. Totally unexpected. But this is what God does. Same thing has happened in this land. In the 18th century, awakening, the time of Wesley and Whitfield, the land was so morally corrupt. Most of the churches had ministers or vicars that couldn't even read. And most of the bishops never ever visited any of their churches. And the morals were totally corrupt throughout every strata of society. But God worked. God raised up. Because he saw what was happening. And surely that must be our prayer. That as we bring these things to him, we come with a sure knowledge that he knows what we're talking about. He knows our deep concerns and our worries. He knows how necessary it is for those things we put right. Plead with him that it might be put right. Some of you might know of the minister Errol Hulse, who sadly died just about a week or so ago. His great clarion call was that we need reformation. We need revival. We need the church to wake up to what the reality is and plead with God that he would act. And that acting often comes in the third thing we see here about God, is that he is the judge. It sounds very harsh, verses 5 and 6. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked, fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. The Lord tests the righteous. Is the Lord testing us? Is he bringing us to this situation that our faith and our trust might be tested? That in his strength and his grace and his power, we might be fitted for the task that is before us. Revival speaks of bringing back life. Life is in the church, not outside the church. That spiritual life. And we need that life to be, as it were, brought to life again. Two elderly ladies on the Isles of Lewis prayed for months and months and months that the Lord would send revival. And the Lord did in that area not many years ago. A revival that touched so many. People going to the local village store and post office were converted in those places. A ship's captain in Hong Kong, who came from the Isle of Lewis, felt a compulsion that he needed to go back, and he had time in Hong Kong while his ship was there He gets on a plane and he flies back to the Isle of Lewis. He is converted. The Lord does amazing things. And you would think of, what can two older ladies do? You may be thinking, it's very well for him to go on about revival. What can I do? You can do what they did. And never cease in that praying until that revival come. Claim that from the Lord, that he would fulfill his word and he will judge. You know, we should feel deeply concerned about many in our society at the moment. They are so guilty. If the Lord's judgment comes, that could be horrific. Pray that in his wrath, he would truly remember mercy and draw many to himself. And the last thing is, God is righteous. Verse 7, the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. God never forsakes his righteousness. God always acts in accord with that righteousness. God will always do that is totally and fully righteous. And that's what we need. That God in his righteousness would work. That he would show forth his power. That he would show forth his grace. May he truly be pleased to manifest himself. So that when that question comes to our mind, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? What the righteous can do is pray to the righteous God that he would demonstrate and act in accord with his sovereignty, his awareness, his judgment and his righteousness. Amen.